Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Every year, millions of Americans are exposed to a contagious virus.
What is this virus? It's stigma.
Stigma promotes an environment of shame,
fear, and silence,
which prevents millions of people from seeking help.
But there's good news.
The National Alliance on Mental Illness believes stigma towards mental illness is 100% curable.
So do yourself and everyone a favor.
Go to curestigma.org and get tested for stigma.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keith. I'm your host, Joy Keith, and I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter at Joy Keith. Also, check us out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keith. And on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keith. You can also email me. I'd love to hear from you. My email is SaturdaysWithJoyKeith@hotmail.com. And if you miss a show or you come in the middle, all the shows are archived. You can check them out here at Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts, you can check them out there. And if they don't have them, you say, hey, knock, knock, you need to get this podcast on your list. This morning, I'm talking to, well, I want to say a writer, but, like, she has so many other talents, which we'll talk about during the interview. But currently, she's a writer, editor, and voice actor. This is her first book, Some of My Best Friends, Essays on Lip Service. It came out this year. She's the co-editor of the essay anthology, The World as We Knew It, Dispatches from a Changing Climate, that also came out this year. And her essays have appeared in dozens of outlets across the U.S. and Canada. She is the editor-in-chief of Catapult Magazine, the former digital editor for The Walrus, and has also edited for Electric Literature. A voice actor for over two decades, Taja can be heard assuming various guises and accents on such animated shows as Atomic Betty, The Berenstain Bears, Super Why, Go Dog Go, My Big Friend, Jane and the Dragon, and many others. Good morning, Taja. How are you?
Good morning, Joy. I'm good, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I want to let the listeners know she woke up really early this morning to talk to me, so you guys please pay attention to what she's saying, you know, and send her some accolades after the interview. She's on the East Coast, and but it's just early. So now you're a voice actor. What does that mean? Because, you know, some people may not be clear about what does that mean. What is that job like?
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, I work primarily in cartoons and animation. So I provide voices for animated characters for TV series, for animated movies. And very occasionally I'll also work in commercials, which is also a big part of voiceover work, the commercials that, you know, we hear on TV and the radio. And that's a line of work that I've been in for coming up on 20 years now.
So why voice acting and not like in front of the TV or on stage, or do you also do that as well?
So I started acting when I was very young, and I was a kid who was very into community theater, and I loved to perform, to be on stage, and I knew that, you know, this was something I wanted to do professionally. And I ended up kind of falling into cartoons and voice work more than anything else because there's just a lot. I came into the industry at a time when a lot of that work was being done in Toronto, and Toronto remains a real sort of hub for voiceover work. And I took to the work right away. I was a big reader as a kid. I liked that the work was sort of, it was easier to keep up while I was in school, whereas, you know, if you're doing on-camera TV, you have long days on set. And I just, I loved the energy of it.
Now, you also, I found out you read your book for people who listen to the audio.
And
so
that was really
Was that like easy, or was that more difficult than doing one of the cartoon characters?
Well, I'd done a couple of audiobooks before, and I knew I loved very kind of, I don't know, I find recording audiobooks very relaxing and almost meditative, but I didn't know if that's how I would feel doing my own. But I was pleasantly surprised when I went into the studio that it felt almost like I was able to sort of bring my professionalism as a voice actor to it, and I didn't get too sort of caught up in the material as its writer. It just felt like I was reading a really good book.
Okay. I was reading your essay that you had written about your experience doing the book and some of the snafus you had in there, but then you got into a flow with it. And a lot of actors have been reading their own books now. They've been doing their memoirs and they read their books.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's others that don't. So, and I've done myself, I was resistant to doing like listening to audiobooks. I tried and I was like, oh, I can't take this. I need to just read it myself. And then because I read so much for the show, the audiobook actually has become a good friend to me because I can like speed up or slow down, this, that, and other.
Yeah.
And I'm more comfortable, you know, with it now. But I know people who, I can't listen while I'm driving though. Like, I know people like, oh, yeah, listen,
interesting.
I'm driving to work. I don't know. It's very, like, distracting to, I need to be, like, paying attention. This is just my little thing, pet peeve. Do you have any little pet peeves, like, people maybe not know about? Like, what's some of your pet peeves you have?
About books specifically? Or
I mean, I don't know. Like, the toothpaste has to be rolled up, or the toilet paper is a certain way, or, you know, you put your eggs only this with this.
I'm one of those people that believes there is a right way to load a dishwasher. There is only one right way. You can't put the dishes in any way you want. There is there are places where the items have to go.
Okay, and what is that order? Is it like the cups first, then the plates, the pots, or what's the order?
Plates have their place at the bottom. Bowls go on the top. Bigger items are on the bottom. Cups are along the side. I mean, it depends on the dishwasher, but I'm just talking about mine.
Yeah. That's okay. Everybody has something. Now, one of the things you do talk about is white actors playing black characters in the cartoon industry, and that, I guess, journey of how now a lot of white actors have stepped down. Do you think they should have stepped down? Should they have kept their jobs? What is your opinion? Can you share that with the audience about white actors playing black characters in like cartoons and things?
Yeah, I mean, so that's one of the essays in the book is about the cartoon industry, largely my experiences in it, and I do talk about that moment in the summer of 2020 when we did see a lot of very high profile actors stepping down from playing characters of color. And I guess my contention is that those actors stepping down was sort of presented as, talked about as if it was a solution to the various problems of racism and inequity that plague the entertainment industry. And so my opinion is, like, you know, good first step, but that alone is not at all enough to solve the kind of broader systemic problems that we see in the industry. Because if the new rule is black characters should only be played by black people, that ignores the question of, for example, how many black characters are there? Because there aren't that many to begin with. So, you know, who is being preemptively shut out of the industry? Who is getting to write these scripts? Who is running these shows? Who's directing these shows? Who's getting to tell these stories at all? What I was interested in was not so much, it was not sort of just the actors renouncing those roles, but the way that that was really just the tip of the iceberg, and I felt like the rest of the iceberg was sort of absent in the public conversation at the time.
Now, what do you think about Black actors from Britain coming over playing like historical Black figures, you know, like Martin Luther King or other characters that are
mm-hmm.
historical figures and close to the heart of a lot of African Americans? What do you think about that?
I think it depends very much on what the form is and how much the question of authenticity is important to that form. Like for something like, I mean, if you're talking about a biopic, for example, authenticity, having like, you know, an actor who is African American rather than a Black British actor, you know, authenticity is sort of more important in that conversation than it is, for example, in cartoons, where the goal has never been to be faithful to reality. And that's another reason why it was very strange to me as someone who works in the industry that, you know, when a lot of shows were putting out their statements and apologies, they were like, oh, we're going to make it more authentic now. And I was like, but this is cartoons. Like, why all of a sudden are we trying to act like we're making a biopic? I think it really depends on, you know, what the project is, what the goals of the project are, what form you're working in, who's making it.
Now you also sing. And I listen, like I told you earlier, I listened to some of your music, you're singing, you play the piano. When did that start, the singing? Was that also when you started very young as a child, or was that later in life?
I started taking piano lessons as a very young child. As I was 4 or 5, my grandfather is a piano teacher, and so that just kind of happened naturally. And I did classical lessons, singing was always, there was a while before the, singing was always just a kind of hobby, a passion, which it remains. And the two kind of met at a point where, I was getting very bad at, keeping up with practicing piano. So to sort of rediscover my love for the instrument, I started writing my own songs, and I started accompanying myself while I sang them, and that was sort of a way to fall back in love with the instrument.
Do you play any other instruments?
No, I don't. I've tried to play various other instruments, but I have never stuck with them the way that I have stuck with the piano.
Yeah. Now, you made a complete U-turn and decided, I'm going to go to law school. And I think I sent over, like, well, why not Yale Drama? What was that about?
I mean, that's a great question. I think for a very long time, I was worried, and I think justifiably so, just given the available opportunities, about taking the risk of fully dedicating myself to a creative life. Like the risks are so high, the margin for failure is so high. And like I mentioned earlier that, you know, part of the reason I really took to cartoon work was because it was something that I could keep up alongside being a student. And so for the longest time, I felt that the safest thing to do was just to kind of have a sort of, you know, build as much as I could, a kind of normal, stable life for myself, and my artistic pursuits would always be something that I kept up on the side. So that was very much the thinking that motivated me to decide to go to law school. But it was, at the end of those 3 years, it was very apparent to me that the world of legal practice was not right for me. And that was, I know it's a strange point to make this decision, but that was really the point when I thought, when I thought, okay, I have to give this, like, you know, my writing is so important to me. I can't shut that in a drawer. I have to give this world a decent shot. Like, I can't always sort of keep it in the margins. I have to see what the possibility, I have to at least try to see what the possibility of a creative life could look like. Mm-hmm. And then I got really lucky.
Well, you have this book. It's called Some of My Best Friends, Essays on Lip Service. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about it? We've talked a little bit. And then also, could you read some from the book?
Absolutely. So Some of My Best Friends is a collection of personal and critical essays that all kind of explore this phenomenon that we've seen in the world very intensely in the past few years, but as I argue in the book, it goes back much longer than that, of various institutions and corporations getting very good at paying lip service to things like equity and diversity and social justice. But the ways that we so rarely see that backed up by action. So it's a book that's very interested in language, very interested in sort of tokenizing gestures. And it examines fields that I have had personal and professional experience in. Like, every essay focuses on a different industry or aspect of culture,
yes.
Like cartoons, the literary industry, the law, publishing. And it sort of looks at this concept of lip service at different levels and scales. Shall I read it?
Okay. Yes, definitely.
So I'm going to read the first few pages of an essay called This Time It's Personal. It's about the digital media sphere, specifically the phenomenon of the online personal essay, where it was a certain moment in the sort of in the aughts and 2010s when a lot of young writers were sort of using the forum to break into the industry. And when it comes to racialized writers especially, they were sort of encouraged to write about and sensationalize their pain. So I'm going to read the beginning of that essay.
Okay.
My first ever stab at a personal essay is saved on my hard drive as personalessay.x. Clearly, I only plan to hit it once. Getting serious about the form seemed like a bad idea. In 2016, people talked about the genre like the circus had packed up and gone. Writers had eaten fire and swallowed swords and bared every conceivable crevice. Sure, you might be a bona fide freak, but even so, how are you going to outdo what had already been done? Admitting I wanted to try felt gauche and possibly a route to grievous bodily harm. While none of these fears were well-founded, they tainted the air enough that I held my breath. I also had my own private doubts about the essay. Hunger made me seek out collections and bookshops. Vicarious shame made me slap covers shut. No matter how great a writer's life seemed to be, everything always hurt when they pressed on it, like the joke about going to the doctor with a broken finger. At the same time, I envied the anthropological clarity these writers brought to their pain. They seemed to perceive their lives and the forces that shaped them more keenly than I did mine. I would try it, I decided, just once, in secret. The essay I wrote is about growing up a speck in the eye of a white suburb, a story I'd been raised to believe was flecked with prejudice, but not infected by it. As a child, I was taught to see discrimination as patterned only insofar as it acted upon large groups of people. And even then, the context was usually a brief history lesson. What happened to me in school and on the street was portrayed more like lightning. Scorching, sure, but also random and discreet. A personal essay seemed like the right vehicle to collect all the counter evidence. My desire to make sense of myself and my story was genuine, but my aims were also mercenary. I wasn't pressing on these memories because it hurt so good to do it, but because they seemed like the kind of thing that got published online. Not that I was ever planning to do anything like that. The grievance was amounted to 5,000 words titled, After Zora Neale Hurston, A Sharp White Background. My sample size had taught me that subtlety was not required. Paragraphs came easy, the process feeling frictionless, the way an art can when you don't know enough of its rules to be hard on yourself. Writing, as I knew it, was dense and heavy work, and fiction had taught me the labor it takes to look graceful. But the lightness of this essay's composition felt all out of scale with the heft of the result, like I'd been playing in the sand and unearthed a buried skeleton, grisly and inevitable, and so near the surface it seemed like a health risk. I hadn't constructed something so much as extracted it, and now that it sat, steaming and exposed to the air, I was horrified by the pit it had come from. Had I really been carrying around this gaping sense of woundedness for my entire life? Was I in danger of bleeding out? Worse, was this a deeply unfunny vibe I gave off as a person? All things considered, I thought my childhood had been pretty good. And yet, the essay inflected my character with something noble, too. The idea that, as I moved through the world, I silently nurtured this yawning hurt by virtue of who I was. I thought I'd suck the poison out, sentences, and that was where the story would end, especially since even more people, by then, were saying that the personal essay had straight up died. But then, a few weeks later, I had a thought about how something else that had happened in my life had been shaped by painful feelings of difference. Then another. My relationship to memory had suddenly become the trick where the clown, in mixed wonder and dread, keeps pulling knotted handkerchiefs out of his mouth. How far down do they go? Are they crammed in his trachea? Curled in his stomach? 6 years later, I'm not horrified, nor even really surprised, that this was the tune that emerged when I tried to sing the inaugural song of myself. After all, I'd been keeping an eye on the writers at the Vanguard, seeing what kind of behavior got rewarded, and I've always been a canny mimic. My essay struck a set of poses common to a certain type of personal story, an implied sameness between being racialized and feeling existential pain, anxiety over an imagined failure to embody authenticity, seeing one's reflection in popular media as a political endgame. Though these are very much tropes, they also gave me a way to express something that felt, at the time, both vivid and true. They didn't, small mercy, get me published, at least not that first time. I've encountered versions of this essay many times in the years since. I've read and reread it, assigned it, rejected it. I've seen it castigated by satires and complaints, but also summoned by submissions calls and expensive book deals. I've written it a few more times, too, though not often on purpose. Various market forces guide writers into producing this kind of piece. Sometimes, writers guide themselves. That there's an ongoing appetite for it says something essential about the reading public and the language we use to tell the story of selfhood.
Thank you.
One of the things you talk in that chapter is about trauma porn and writers of color being, I guess, strutted out, if I use that word, into the world to people like insatiable hunger for, ooh, they're in pain, ooh, this and that. Mm-hmm. Do you continue to write that way, or you continue to force to write that way? As an editor, do you look for things to make trauma porn out of?
Oh, gosh, no.
No, I'm just wondering if you have, forces above you, that's like, oh, no, you got to choose this because
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I'm so lucky that I'm in a position in my career now where I do have more control over what I write, and I, am able to have more of a say in how that's presented. This essay is very sort of specific to a time in my life where I was just starting out as a writer and sort of trying to find my way into the industry. I felt that my voice was often only welcomed if I was willing to tell stories of my own suffering, and if I was willing to sort of make that suffering sound worse than often than it had actually been. Absolutely, as an editor, I mean,
being able to sort of push back against that tendency is part of the reason I wanted to become an editor, you know, so I could be in a position where I'm able to, you know, commission more more minoritized writers and allow them to kind of write about whatever they want and sort of not feel like they're pigeonholed. And it's, you know, it's an incredible privilege to be able to you know, to do that. And it's also, like, I take that responsibility very seriously.
Do you think artists should be activists? Is it the job of an artist to be an activist, or should they leave that to other people?
I think that word will mean different things to different artists. I think our work, for some artists, you know, our work is political, and our sort of our politics, our sort of, and our, you know, activism is, it can be inseparable from putting out work into the world. I don't think it's a prerequisite of artistry. I think, you know, to come back to the notion of authenticity, everyone needs to find what sort of, how much of that they want to, you know, let into their work, and they are able to kind of embody in an authentic way, both on and off the page.
One of the things you do talk about in the book, White Fragility, and you focus around a lot of women and women in different TV shows and things like that. I was surprised that, have you ever thought about writing about white male fragility in the sense of the, like the incels? Because I feel like they're fragile, even though they seem very angry and fragile, but to me that I think they're fragile.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's so much fantastic writing out there about sort of, I guess, toxic masculinity and the ways that that intersects with whiteness and with, you know, a fear of having one's power, a false fear of having one's power taken away. So, you know, I felt like that conversation was already kind of very healthy, and there's been a lot of great published work on that. Where I felt like I had an opportunity to contribute to the conversation was talking about white femininity, which, as I argue in the book, you know, has been sort of mapped less and discussed less, and more often gets a pass. And that was very interesting to me. I was like, let's examine a bunch of, like, so many of the big cultural sort of moments and movements of the past few decades have been, you know, white women have been at the vanguard, like the, you know, the personal essay boom and the, like, the 90s rom-com and the sort of the, like, the first person writing and trauma memoir of the early aughts. And I thought, something there. And nobody's really connected the dots between all those things yet. Yeah, that was really what drew me to writing about white femininity.
Well, I have some quick questions, nothing to do with the book. If you had a superpower, what would it be?
Ooh, that's a good one. If I had a superpower, I was always that kid who had, like, really intense dreams about being able to fly. So I know it's very sort of simple and mechanical, but, you know, that would do a lot for me.
That would do a lot. Save on, like, air flight tickets and things of that nature.
I know. I love to travel.
So if you could travel anywhere in the world, where would you go and who would you take?
I could travel anywhere in the world. I mean, I'm very lucky that I do get to travel very often, but in terms of the places I've never been that I'd like to go, I'd love to go to Greece and do some island hopping. And I would take my husband. He loves to travel more than I do.
Okay, that's a good answer, because that way you can get, you know, stay home. Because if you didn't say him, he'd be like, what? You going to take who? if you only had $100, what would you do with it?
Oh. Buy books?
I can see that. I can see that. And lastly, are you turkey and cheese or peanut butter and jelly person?
Ooh. It depends on what kind of cheese. I would probably
okay,
go
let's talk about
peanut butter
that.
And jelly.
Oh, peanut butter
yeah,
and jelly.
I mean,
okay, so now what makes a good peanut butter and jelly sandwich, though?
I am of the belief that you want a lot of peanut butter and minimal jelly. I don't know if that's divisive.
Uh-huh. And is it the crunchy or is it the smooth kind?
Smooth kind for me.
Smooth kind for you. And what about the bread? Do you do like white bread or whole wheat bread?
I would probably go for whole wheat bread.
Okay. Okay. Healthy, you know, kind of multigrain. All right. I mean, these things are important, you know, because people are listening and, you know, they might want to try it and they'll be like, okay, this is good for me. I never thought about that. A lot of people might be like, I only eat it on white bread. I'm just saying, you know,
that's fair.
Tasha, where are you on social media? Where can people follow you?
People can follow me on Twitter, at Tasha Eisen. I'm on Instagram as well under the same handle, and they can always find me on my website, TashaEisen.com.
Excellent, excellent. I'm going to give away some copies of your book. So, you're welcome. Some of my best friends, Essays on Lip Service. You guys want to win a copy? Follow me on Twitter at Joy Keys. Check us out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys, so that you can win a copy of Tasha's book, Some of My Best Friends. So have you already started writing a second book? Can you give us a hint? What's next?
I haven't started yet. I feel like I have a couple of ideas for where I'd like to go with the next project, but I'm going to wait until I need to give myself a bit of space.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, good luck with everything. And thank you again for coming on the show this morning.
Thank you again for having me.
And have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich today for me.
I will. Thanks, Joy.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Just got off the phone with the writer of Some of My Best Friends, Essays on Lip Service. Again, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram to possibly win a copy of the book. And you can also email me on SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. And also, again, if you missed the show or you come in the middle, all the shows are archived. Check them out on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. Thank you again, and I hope to see you guys next Saturday.
Stigma may not directly affect you,
but it harms the 1 in 5 Americans living with mental health conditions,
which prevents millions of people from seeking help.
So do yourself and everyone a favor.
Go to curestigma.org and get tested for stigma.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.